Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We all turn it into the Super Bowl for different reasons. And if you don't know, the big game is this Sunday. Some of us actually want to watch the game. Others are there for the halftime show. Some people just want to eat wings. No matter why you sit down this Sunday, though, chances are you'll see a lot of commercials.
In Austin, it's 60 degrees with a...
Alexa?
Amazon's Alexa lost her voice this morning, causing a
wave. Alexa lost her voice? How is that even possible?
We have the replacements ready. Just say the word.
And you're sure this is going to work?
Alexa, call Brandon.
I'm afraid Brandon is a little tied up.
But do let me know if there's anything I can help you with. Jessica?
Advertisers have been counting on this for years, but now that the digital space remains supreme with the ability to individually target ads, you have to wonder if it matters how catchy or outrageous, for example, Doritos will be with a commercial. Does it matter more that Doritos knows where you live and how often you buy them? Joining us now to help answer these questions is EJ Schultz. He's on the line with us from Chicago, where he's the bureau chief for Ad Age. Hey, EJ, welcome back to the 21st.
Great to be here.
So there's lots of TV nights. I feel like in January, this is kind of January, February, the time of year they know people are home and watching TV, the Oscars, all the award shows. How does the Super Bowl stack up in terms of what advertisers want compared to, say, like the World Series?
Sure. There's a lot of changes obviously going on in media and communications, but there's one constant, which is that the Super Bowl is still by far the biggest show in town when it comes to drawing viewers. We're expecting, again, this will draw at least 100 million people. And to put that in context, the Grammys that ran
just last week
only drew about 19.8 million. So that gives you a sense of the size of this event still.
And so is it still also then the most expensive ad buys, television ad buys companies can make?
That's correct. Yeah, we're tracking ads, I believe, are running for about 5 million for just 30 seconds, which pretty much blows most of other stuff out of the water still.
And it used to be that there were just a few ways advertisers could reach their audiences. Now there's social media, there's streaming, there's apps. As an example, I know this isn't a Super Bowl ad, but I wanted to play this recent Burger King net neutrality commercial.
Hey, how you doing?
You know what number 98, what's going on with it?
Number 98, you got the Whopper?
Yeah.
So you got the slow access Whopper pass?
Wait. What?
It's on the menu right there with the fast, medium, and slow.
Slow MBPS, fast MBPS, or hyper fast MBPS. MBPS, of course, standing for making burgers per second.
So if we want a Whopper now, we have to pay $26?
Well, that's how you get it fast. That's the highest priority.
This is like a lane system?
It's going to be like 15, yeah, fast lane, slow lane. So like maybe like 15, 20 minutes.
Okay, that's Burger King's attempt to explain net neutrality, which they do a really good job of, by the way. EJ, I wanted to play that for you because I wanted to make the point. I saw that ad on Facebook. I don't really watch ads anymore. I don't think I'm unusual in this. I hardly ever watch live TV. But that video where I saw it first on Facebook has been viewed 14 million times. I checked on YouTube this morning, 4 million views. Is that kind of how things are working now more in the advertising space?
To a large degree, yes. Although I would say that, although that ad broke through and was hugely successful, as you pointed out, there's, you know, many, many more attempts that don't go anywhere. So when comparing that approach to the Super Bowl, which TV-wise, which is a lot more expensive, obviously, you know, when you put an ad on the Super Bowl, you're guaranteed to get a fair amount of attention no matter what, just because it's sort of the one event of the year that people really do still, or a large portion of people really do still watch for the advertising.
So let's look at some of the ads for this Sunday. I think companies to this point about digital also have kind of pretty elaborate strategies now for releasing things on a digital basis, sometimes even before the Super Bowl, right?
Yes, we've been, you know, that's been going on for many years now where they'll release the ad on YouTube, you know, and we saw the first ad released by Stella Artois, the Anheuser-Busch beer brand, about 3 weeks ago. And this, you know, this week, in the week leading up to the Super Bowl, obviously we see more and more to the point where there's very few actual surprises in the game. There are still brands that are going to hold back their ads, but for the most part, I'd say the vast majority are released early these days. That way you get that sort of digital hit as well. Because next week after the game, you know, no one's really going to care about these ads anymore. They're going to move on to the next thing, whether it be the Oscars or whatever's going on in the world.
Yeah, so this is kind of the week that companies can get the bigger bang for their buck, I assume, by trying to get as much eyes on it this week and then leading up to the game.
Absolutely. I mean, you're sort of playing into the anticipation of the game itself. I mean, it's pretty slow in sports right now because, you know, the NFL has been off for the last 2 weeks, so they're trying to fill that void.
AJ, what stands out to you? I should add to note to our audience before you answer that. EdAge has a bunch of them online. We'll tweet out a link for people who want to see them. What are you using so far?
We're seeing, not surprisingly, the usual array of silly advertising. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Bud Light campaign that's been going on for a couple months now called Dilly Dilly. So not surprisingly, they're coming up with another Dilly Dilly ad, and they're introducing a new character called Bud Knight.
Oh,
what
well,
else would you expect?
You know, EJ, we actually have a little bit of it. Let's play some of that Bud Light ad, and then let's talk about Dilly Dilly, because I don't know anything about it.
Look! It's the Bud Knight. It's the Bud Knight. We're saved.
Yes.
Dilly Dilly!
Time to do what must be done.
All right, that's the Bud Knight. We heard that Dilly Dilly in there. EJ, what is that about?
They started this campaign late last year, and it's essentially sort of a riff on the whole Game of Thrones medieval world that's become popular in pop culture last year, and it's sort of their spoof version of it. And that phrase is essentially just sort of a medieval version of Cheers. It's a pretty simple idea, and it's just sort of a silly made-up phrase that really, for whatever reason, caught fire online and became sort of viral. And so they're sort of riding that as much as they can by introducing these different, you know, medieval characters into the plot. And the newest one is Bud Knight, who sort of looks like you'd expect him to look, with sort of blue armor. You know, he's carrying a sword, and then in the ad he's actually stops over at a convenience store to pick up some beer in the middle of sort of a medieval battlefield scene.
And so there's also always the standards, Coke and Pepsi. I think we've got a Coke ad here.
We all have different looks and loves.
Likes and dislikes, too.
But there's a Coke for we.
And us.
And there's a Coke for you.
Angie, that kind of gets to a theme. Coke has done this before, right? Where they are making it about love and community and all of these other things and not the beverage.
Right. It's been part of the Coke DNA for many, many years. You can go back to the classic Hilltop ad when, you know, the brand was trying to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. This year's ad is interesting to me in the sense that it is also playing off a diversity theme. The ad itself shows many sort of diverse faces, but I believe it's going to be less controversial than an ad they did back in 2014, which was called It's Beautiful, which was their take on America the Beautiful, the patriotic song, and they had people singing it in different languages, and that drew you know, a lot of conversation along the political spectrum of people, sort of, you know, some people in the certain political persuasions thinking it wasn't appropriate, whatnot. I mean, you can argue that, but it got them a lot of attention, which is sort of the bottom line for these advertisements. This year, I feel like they took a similar approach, but much with a lighter touch, right? The ad itself is much more about Coca-Cola. They're trying to say, you know, there's a Coke for everyone. But they're still, you know, leaning heavily into sort of promoting diversity and unity and, you know, we're all different, but we can come together as one.
Right. And there was a big, that was kind of, I don't know if controversy is the right word, but certainly got a lot of attention last year around immigration. And it was Anheuser-Busch, right? The story of him being an immigrant and coming in making beer?
Warum bist du aus Deutschland?
I want to brew a beer.
Welcome to America.
You don't want it here. Go back home.
They sort of tried to retell the story of Adolphus Busch, who was a German immigrant who came to the United States. In a normal year, that's hardly controversial, but with you know, the current president and a lot of the conversation about immigration, people started viewing that ad last year with a political lens. You know, Anheuser-Busch at the time said that was not intended at all. I mean, and I know the ad was created many, many months before
Because it was right after the travel ban.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. But the ad was in a works for a while. But that's just a perfect example of how the Super Bowl is at this stage, and people are going to kind of see whatever they want in some of these advertisements.
And how do advertisers handle that? Because some companies like Burger King, you know, they've taken this is their position. Like, they're like, this is our brand. We're going to take a position on net neutrality and explain why we think it's bad. We don't, you know, this is whether you want to view that as a political position or not. This is the stand we're taking. How do companies balance that between making politics or delving into that being a part of their brand versus just trying to stay away?
You know, it's interesting. One of the things we're looking at this Super Bowl, and I think the trend that we can see already, is that there's more brands sort of avoiding even anything remotely political in any of the ads that have been released so far. There's really nothing that I see as all that controversial. We're seeing the caution, I think, this year, that brands maybe don't even want to get pulled into that conversation. I mean, the obvious benefit is you get attention and you can be seen as looking progressive. But if you're a mainstream brand like Pepsi or Coke or Bud Light, you're trying to market to everyone, you really don't want to be seen as taking a side.
And are there any newcomers to the stage this year, new companies? Sometimes people use this as an opportunity to introduce themselves to people. Are there companies that maybe traditionally haven't done big ad buys that we're going to see this year in this year's Super Bowl?
So far, there are a handful, but it's according to our tracking, it's down a little bit from last year. And you never know who's going to appear at the last minute, so I don't want to say that definitively. But you know, one of the interesting newcomers is Amazon Prime Video, which has bought a Super Bowl ad to promote one of their new original series, the Jack Ryan series.
United, there is little we cannot do to assure the survival of liberty.
Jack Ryan. There must be some kind
of way out of here. It will not be easy. Send the Joker to the thief. We will face challenges.
And even in the toughest times.
And then in the consumer packaged goods world, Pringles is in the game for the first time.
Barbecue Pringles? Pizza Pringles.
You made barbecue pizza.
Wow.
Wow.
Add a jalapeno.
Spicy barbecue pizza.
Wow.
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 Wow, you can stack different flavors?
Nobody asked you, Kevin!
Wow.
So those are a couple newcomers this year.
I'm speaking with EJ Schultz, who's talking to us from the Chicago Bureau of Ad Age. EJ, I just wanted to ask you, as we think about new companies and and sort of delving into all of this advertising realm, do you feel like it's still a situation where the Super Bowl is really the premier destination and it's still a worthwhile investment, it sounds like, for lots of companies?
I would say so, with a very big caveat that if done right, because if you make a mistake or produce an ad that's not well received, you can cause more damage than harm to your brand. We've had examples of that over the years. So it's a high stakes gamble, really, when you're spending that much money and you're going to be getting 100 million people watching your ad. It's a really high stakes game.
That said, I wonder how much this factors in. It seems like, and I've had conversations with a couple of sports journalists about this, how much interest, there's a lot of interest that's sort of waned in the NFL in the past year. They've had their own share of controversy. Do you think that's going to affect viewership in the game?
I don't think so. One of my colleagues did a story on this recently, pointing out that I think historically there's not a huge correlation between the regular season viewership and then what ends up happening during the game. I think it's much more than a sporting event. It's a cultural event. It's still one of the few times a year everyone sort of gathers around their television sets. And I don't see that changing this year or anytime soon, to be honest.
So does that said, what do you watch the game? Are you going to be, or do you think I've seen this all already?
I will watch the game, but unfortunately I'll have to have my head buried in my laptop as well, just to make sure, you know, the companies that we cover are, you know, doing anything silly or smart on social media that is going to cause controversy or praise or whatnot. So I'll have, like probably a lot of people, multiple screens going during the game.
Right. Because this is a working event for you, I imagine, for anyone who's in the ad business, right?
It is, but it does make it easier when the brands release their ads early. I've written plenty of stories already.
That's EJ Schultz. He's a Chicago bureau chief for Ad Age. We will tweet out some of those columns that EJ has done. EJ, thanks again for joining us on the 21st. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you think A Night at the Symphony isn't for you because you don't know your Beethoven from your Brahms, what about these symphonic tones? That, of course, is music from the great American composer John Williams from a little movie called Star Wars. But take away the visual pairing of spaceships and laser fights, you have all of the makings of a great classical piece of music. And the Illinois Symphony Orchestra is presenting the best of John Williams, Star Wars and Beyond, this weekend. There's a show this evening in Bloomington and Saturday night in Springfield. We'll have all of that information on our website. But with me now are two members of the ISO. Amanda Pond performs the flute with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, as well as the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra. She studied music here at the University of Illinois. Mark Moore is the principal tuba player with the orchestra. He's also a professor of tuba and euphonium at the U of I. Amanda and Mark are here in our performance studio at WILL. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
So I want to ask you both about your history as musicians, but first I think we have to talk Star Wars and John Williams. Mark, how amongst yourselves as musicians do you refer to these kinds of concerts and compositions as opposed to, say, a Mendelssohn or a Mozart?
Well, it's kind of special with John Williams because I don't know any orchestra musician who doesn't love John Williams' music. John Williams studied a lot of classical music, and you'll find a lot of characterizations from John Williams that he stole from Prokofiev, a Russian composer, or lots of other composers. So we go, oh yeah, that's where he stole that, that's where he stole that, that's where he stole that. And his music is a lot of fun to play. I've played a lot of it many, many times. I don't regret it. It's always fun to play. He has even written a tuba concerto for the tuba,
which we are going to hear a little of
in
a minute. Amanda, so you're not saying to yourselves, oh, it's pop night at the symphony?
No, absolutely not. We, like Mickey said, I think he is such a skillful writer that it's a lot of fun for us, actually. And, you know, he does really borrow from Richard Strauss and Wagner, especially, and Mahler, I think, quite a bit. And it's like it's nice variety for us. It's a good change of pace.
Do you all have favorite movies that are John Williams compositions also?
Actually, one of the very first ones that I recognized and started paying attention to John Williams' music was Close Encounters. And it came out, I think, 1977 or something like that. And my wife and I were in the theater, and I didn't know anything about the movie or anything about John Williams. But right in the middle of the movie, when the mothership finally comes down, and they're communicating through music, which is the whole theme of the film, and all of a sudden, the human on Earth is speaking to the mothership, and that is represented by the oboe in the symphony. And finally, the mothership answers, and it's a tuba.
So I feel like you have to play that for us now. Can you? Can I impose upon you? So Mark, your nickname Mickey. Mickey, yeah, will you? Yes. Okay, there you go.
If I can remember. And I went nuts. And then I found out that he loves brass. He's written all kinds of pieces. And actually, in Jaws, which is one of his early films too, the very first solo instrument in that film is a tuba solo. So they just start going backwards and back. And there was a movie that he wrote a score for called The Reavers, which is a William Faulkner movie. And in the middle of that movie, there's a 5-minute absolutely alone tuba solo that I saw the tuba player from the Boston Pops and play one time on a Boston Pops concert. And I started screaming during that one, too. And luckily, I was home when that happened, so no one yelled at me then.
Amanda, what about you? When you go to, do you have a favorite John Williams?
Yeah, definitely. I love the music from Harry Potter. I had read all the books and was eagerly awaiting the movies. And then I was sitting in the movie theater, and the opening scene, I immediately knew it was John Williams' music, and I knew he did just a perfect job of kind of characterizing a magical world and just like even the first moments of the film.
When you say you immediately knew it was John Williams' music, how?
That's a good question. There's something about the way he writes. It's both, it's super skillful and also like pop music in the same way, and all the good parts of pop music that capture your imagination, and then all the skill and complexity of classical music. It's just, it has a very unique sound, and you can tell who he is.
Do you mean that, so by the pop music, do you mean also that sort of how it kind of, there's like a hook or something that kind
exactly.
of catches you? So
it's catchy, yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So now that you've said that, would you mind playing sure. some Harry Potter for us?
Sure, sure.
That's Amanda Pond. She's a flutist with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in our performance studio, along with her colleague, Mark Mickey Moore, principal tuba player with the orchestra. This weekend, the Illinois Symphony Orchestra is presenting the best of John Williams' Star Wars and Beyond. There's a show this evening in Bloomington, Saturday night in Springfield. Mark, for you, or when you are playing John Williams, do you find that it's a different audience than the normal audience for the Illinois Symphony, or what do you think?
Usually, yes. Especially for this one, I assume there'll be lots of young children in the audience to enjoy the movie. And, you know, I think everybody is going to love John Williams' music because he writes very, very well. And they'll enjoy the concert. Maybe they'll come for more stuff, you know, and... That's okay with us, too. Actually, we were talking to one of the people in the symphony office, and the concert in Bloomington is almost sold out. The concert in Springfield, we have one more whole balcony that they can open up, so there's a lot more room. But you know, we're looking for big crowds this weekend, so we're very excited about that, too.
And what is the energy? Was the energy different when you're playing something like this, Amanda, when it's a lot of young people in the audience, or maybe kids who are probably super excited because it's the Star Wars theme, and I don't know if they cheer or what it's like?
Definitely. It's a totally different atmosphere. There's a lot of energy, and people love hearing music that's familiar to them. And so a lot of times the seats are wiggling. All the kids have a ton of nervous energy or excited energy. And in fact, in Springfield beforehand, they're having all this family fun focused stuff, including they're going to make lightsabers out of pool noodles beforehand. And they're going to make Harry Potter bookmarks. You could pick your favorite, the house that you belong to, and make a bookmark. And I think there are already going to be jazzed and energized before they come and sit down to hear us.
Well, there's probably going to be a lot of lightsabers waving along to the music, right?
That's going to be fun for us to see.
So yeah. Can you all give us a little bit of a preview? Amanda, I think you have a few more pieces that just a little mix of things that you can play for us?
Yeah, we're playing. So Mickey mentioned some older movies of John Williams. And so one of the older ones we're doing is from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And there's a real familiar theme to that. I'll play this for you. And another one we're going to do is from a more recent movie, not the old Star Wars trilogy or the prequel movies, but The Force Awakens, I think. This is music from that movie called Rey's theme. So Rey is the protagonist in that movie, and she has a theme. I'm going to play a little bit of a few tunes from there. Rey's theme from The Force Awakens. And then
Amanda, can I ask you about that for a minute?
Sure. Yeah.
So I think that's an interesting one because I think that when we think of John Williams, we think of the things that we know really well.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I wonder if there are pieces like that that maybe kind of even when they're pop culture pieces we miss because it's part. So I wonder, as you all are practicing and rehearsing for this, are there pieces that you have maybe discovered or become your that you like more?
Yeah, this theme in particular, which I, the first time I played it was for a children's concert, like all the schools bussed the kids in to come hear it, and it was the first, I hadn't seen the movie yet, and then when I saw the movie, I, you know, recognized it right away, and I absolutely enjoy it. I think it's really fun, and I think, you know, John Williams does a lot of sort of heroic and big music with lots of brass, and this is a little more thoughtful and contemplative, and I think it's a nice contrast.
Well, it's kind of nice if you think about her character. It's really reflective of the character that she is, too.
I think so,
You were going to play a few things, more things for us?
I just had one more thing. Another kind of category of music that we're doing in the concert has to do with the Olympics. So John Williams has written a lot of music for the Olympics. This one little tune, which we'll hear like a million times in a couple weeks. If you watch the Olympics, that every time, it's like the main theme that they play.
That's Amanda Pond. She's a flutist with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. She also studied music here at the University of Illinois. She also plays for the Champaign-Urbana Symphony Orchestra. Mark Moore is also in studio with us. He's a tuba player. Mark, as we talk about John Williams, you mentioned one of the things that made you so excited was that John Williams has written a lot of pieces for the tuba.
Yes.
He's comparatively speaking, correct?
He was the Pops conductor for the Boston Pops for many, many years. And at that time, he became good friends with the tubist in the orchestra, Chester Schmitz, and wrote in 1988 a full concerto, 20 minutes, for the tuba, which Chester premiered with the Boston Pops. And then I played 9 years later with the Illinois Symphony in 1997. I finally convinced a conductor that we should do John Williams. And so I got to play it with the symphony orchestra. And it's loads and loads of fun.
Well, and that's what I was, because I had a chance to ask Amanda, but not you. As Amanda was playing Rey's song, are there other pieces also that maybe are not as well known, like kind of that you now really enjoy that are John Williams that maybe people might not hear because it's part of the credits or other scenes?
Well, as an example, everyone thinks the Jaws theme that all tuba players relate to is the half step that goes bump, 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 but that's not it. In the movie Jaws, that's played by the bass section of the orchestra, and the tuba solo comes up from nowhere and goes all over the place. And I met Tommy Johnson, who was the freelance tuba player in Los Angeles who played that piece, and he was friends with John Williams. And he showed up for the recording session for Jaws, and he went to the back of the orchestra where we sit, and there was no chair there for him. So the trombone player said, "Go to the front, your chair is up there." So he walks to the front of the orchestra, and there's this chair for the tuba, and it says solo tuba. So Tommy went out to his car and brought in all his tubas that he brings with him to every single gig so that he can be ready to play whatever it is. And then he sight read this part, which is incredibly hard, which I have gotten to play a couple of times with different orchestras. But it was, you know, not in the back, but way in the front as a soloist.
Not where the tuba normally
not
is.
Not where we normally sit. So maybe that gave John the inspiration to write the concerto too.
So, can you play a little bit of the concerto for
I've
us
I've got
now?
A little bit of the concerto.
Thank you. I love the end of that there. That's Mark Moore. He's a tuba player with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. We're almost out of time, both of you, but I just want to come back to one thing that you all said about these concerts and when you play John Williams, how much it brings young people in and how much it changes the energy. And I just wanted to ask you about how important you think music is like this as, I don't know if this was for you all, for if you think that music like this, it's maybe a more important introduction to people who aren't listening to classical music on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. I really think because it's familiar tunes, so people hear the music in the movie, in the movies, but then it's introducing them to the classical orchestra. So if it's really, it's kind of a bridge between popular music and classical music. And a lot of times you'll find at concerts like this, there'll be people who say, "I've never been to an orchestra concert before." And it's so fun to play for new audience members. And we absolutely, I mean, when you're sitting in front of a full symphony orchestra, it's really amazing. It's a really cool sound. And I think that we often get some repeat attenders from concerts like this.
That's the music of John Williams, the best of John Williams. Star Wars and Beyond is this weekend, this evening. Unfortunately, it might be hard to get into Bloomington this evening if you're in Central Illinois. Tomorrow night in Springfield, I want to thank Amanda Pond, flutist and tuba player Mark Moore for joining me. Thanks, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tuning into the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois' current Attorney General Lisa Madigan isn't running for re-election. Today, we're continuing our series of interviews with the 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans hoping to replace her.
Just a note to our audience, here's how we did this like a job interview. We tried to ask every candidate almost the same questions. And to be fair, we recorded all of these interviews in advance. A reminder, the primary is on March 20th. Early voting can begin as early as February 8th. Today, we're hearing from Jesse Ruiz. He's a lawyer who was born and raised on Chicago's South Side in Roseland. He's president of the Chicago Park District Board, was the first Latino to head the Illinois State Board of Education, and was at one point vice president interim CEO of the Chicago Board of Education. He's one of eight Democrats hoping to become our state's next attorney general. Jesse Ruiz, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you, Nala. Pleasure to be here.
So your background up to this point in terms of your public service life has been in education. And I should point out to our audience that during your time on the Chicago Board of Ed, you voted to close that historic number of schools. Why are you interested in the office of attorney general now?
Well, because of that very reason that relates to you're pointing out that we've lost student population, that the American dream is under attack and at risk in our state, and it's under attack by our very own president, by our governor, and working families in Illinois are struggling. As the son of Mexican immigrants, I understand that struggle, and as a lawyer, I've known that I can be an advocate, and I can stand up for people's rights and work hard to make the Office of Attorney General the champion of working families in Illinois and stand up to make sure that every Illinoisan continues to have the same shot at the American dream that I have had. I've been fortunate. My dad came here as a migrant farm worker with just a third grade education, worked hard, and because of his and my mom's sacrifices, I was able to go to the University of Illinois, go there with just $300 in my pocket, come out with my bachelor's degree in economics and only $310,000 in debt, and then go on to the University of Chicago Law School, where I had professors like Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan and President Barack Obama. So I've been fortunate, and I want to ensure that the opportunities I've had in this great state are opportunities that continue to be available for every Illinoisan.
We've seen current Attorney General Lisa Madigan join other attorneys general in suing the Trump administration. You mentioned President Obama. I wanted to mention President Trump. Do you think part of the role of Attorney General is to take on the federal government?
Yes. When they're affronting our rights, you take an oath as Attorney General to defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States and the state of Illinois. And I think you would do that by making sure that everyone, even the President of the United States, who infringes on those rights, is called into question. And we stand up to them and sue them when necessary. Thus, you've seen record numbers of lawsuits by attorneys general across the United States, and they're winning. They are actually winning because these are actual affronts on our constitutional rights. And so we need to continue to call our public officials in check whenever they are affronting the rights of everyday citizens.
You've been very vocal about this, particularly on Twitter, Jesse Ruiz. And I wanted to ask you about, you've been the recipient of some racist tweets that I will not repeat here, but you've gotten since you've started speaking out against the president. Did that surprise you?
A bit. You know that this exists and some of these sentiments exist in a very diverse and large country, but it's always shocking when you're the recipient of racial epithets and frankly of threats. And there is no place for that in a civilized society and in our democracy. Yes, we have First Amendment rights, but it should be constructive and civil. And the only upside is that it exposes what we're confronting and what we have to fight for so that everyone is treated with respect and dignity and equality.
So you've talked about the American dream and how you feel like that's maybe a little bit more difficult now. I wanted to ask you what your most important priorities would be that you would focus on if elected attorney general.
Well, doing just that, I point to the fact that I was able to go to the University of Illinois with just $300 in my pocket, come out with $10,000 in student debt, and then go to work at the Inland Steel Company in Chicago, my first job right out of undergrad, and earn $21,000. Well, that was twice the amount of debt I owed. That math isn't necessarily how it works today. And so I'm concerned, given that for many people, the path to the American dream is a good education. And we have great universities in our state. I want to make sure we continue to invest in them and continue to make that possible. When you have loan companies that are loading students up with incredible amounts of debt at onerous terms and onerous rates, that's not right. And when you have a U.S. Department of Education that's no longer protecting the rights of students to make claims of for-profit colleges and universities, who are doing that and not necessarily giving them marketable job skills. We need to confront those people and make sure students have the ability to afford an education and to make sure that they, if they have to borrow, they can do it at reasonable terms, that it makes it possible to start a career, start a life, own a home, start a family, and do what's part of the American dream and do what most of their parents have worked hard for them to do, to be able to do a bit better than they have.
What do you see then as the main role of Attorney General? You've mentioned, for example, so far taking on loan companies, the president in terms of policies that you think would be prohibited. What else?
Well, you have to ensure that there's no corruption in our government, that there's open, honest, and transparent government that we are all entitled to, that serves us best when it is transparent, and that people have faith and confidence in it. We have to continue to protect our environment, especially in an era where we have a president who is systemically dismantling the U.S. EPA. Places like Central Illinois, if the Mahomet Aquifer were put at risk, where would you get healthy, safe drinking water? And so that's an ultimate concern of mine, that the basic things we need to live, like fresh, safe water, are protected, our air and our land, so that we can get food that we can eat that's safe. So those are concerns. And then across the state, criminal justice reform, especially here in Chicago, is a big issue. Where the next attorney general will have to oversee a consent decree with the city of Chicago, but also make sure we're seeking criminal justice reform across the state in terms of bail reform, in terms of making sure police departments are supported, and in turn we can be protected with integrity and honesty by police officers, give them the support and training they need. It's a very difficult job, and we need to give those local police departments, especially some who are stretched thin in terms of resources, the supports they need to have a very professional police force, and making sure that we are not expanding a prison pipeline, especially of the young minority men. So making sure we address all those issues are critical, as well as protecting our health, access to affordable health care, and confronting the opioid epidemic that's plaguing our state and our country. So there's a number of fronts protecting privacy. Now there's a suit pending against Equifax because of the information that was taken from their databases that is our information, our protected information. And so there are new challenges every day, and it's a broad purview of an office that is, in essence, the largest public interest law firm in the state of Illinois that is the people's advocate, the people's lawyer. And when I serve as Attorney General, I will be the people's champion to stand up for their rights.
So there's a crowded field of seven others who are running for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General in this primary on March 20th. Why should voters choose you?
Well, because of my record of public service as a volunteer, I've been continually practiced law for the past 21 years. I've also been continually engaged in pro bono legal services and have raised money for pro bono legal services that I know is important so that everyone has access to justice, regardless of your ability to pay for legal services. And the fact that I was engaged in public service, even when I wasn't appointed to any office, back when I graduated from Champaign, went back to Roseland Community in the south side of Chicago, I started Little League teams to keep young boys occupied and safe and out of harm's way. I started teaching junior achievement classes at Wendell Smith Elementary School. I started doing a peer retention program at Bowen High School in the southeast side. I got involved with the Community Alliance for Neighborhood Safety to bring community policing to Chicago before we ever had a CAPS program in 1990 to 1992. You'll find WGN TV footage of me as a younger guy in March of 1992 talking to Allison Payne about the need for community policing. So I've been engaged in these efforts to improve our communities, improve our state, long before anybody appointed me to anything. I think that's what we have to look at. What my dad would always say is, what do you do when nobody's looking? What are you doing when nobody asks you to do something, that you take it upon yourself? That's a commitment to service I've always had throughout my life, and I've served with honesty and integrity, and also have stepped in, especially my role as CEO of Chicago Public Schools. When others have stumbled, I've stepped in and fixed issues like the single-source and sole-source contracting systems at CPS. So I have a proven record of doing this, respected in the legal community, and I understand the struggles of working families in Illinois coming from my background and growing up in the Roseland community of Chicago. And so I want to make sure I take that life experience and my legal skills and put it to work on behalf of the people of Illinois.
Jesse Ruiz is one of eight running for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much, Nala.
As we've been talking about this hour this weekend, millions of people will come together over chips and dip during the biggest football game of the year. As that happens, thousands more are also coming together for a different cause and over a different food, soup. For the past 28 years, individuals, churches, and organizations across the country have taken part in a charity event called the Super Bowl of Caring. That's Super, S-O-U-P-E-R. The event began in South Carolina in 1990 when a seminary intern suggested using the Super Bowl weekend as a time to come together by collecting food and money for those in need. Since then, this has spread across the country. According to the organization, participants have raised more than $90 million for charity. On the line with me is one of the places that are organizing a Super Bowl of Caring. Greg Nowicki is the council president of Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Burbank. That's just in Southwest Cook County. Hey, Greg, welcome to the 21st.
Great to be talking to you.
So, Greg, can you tell me about what organization your church raises money for in the Super Bowl of Caring?
Well, we raise funds for various charities. In the past, we have donated to our own food pantry. We have, on occasion, donated money to the Greater Chicago Food Depository. And the last two or three years, the funds we have received have gone to Living Waters, a Lutheran church in Cherokee, North Carolina, which is a very distinctive ministry. They run a food pantry down there in Cherokee. Very poor people there. This is the only Native American Lutheran church in the United States. So it's very distinctive.
So I know some places collect actual food. It sounds like you're collecting money. Is that how it works?
Well, we also collect food. The food we collect stays in our pantry. We run a pantry one morning and one evening each week. It's Our Savior's Food Pantry, and we service the Burbank and Bridgeview area primarily.
So, Greg, I don't know how it works at Our Savior's, but I know at one of my old churches, if you didn't know who was playing in the game, you had to give twice as much money. Do you guys do that?
No, we don't. That's a heck of an idea. We should think about doing that.
Yeah. That was I guess what is it like with your congregation? Is there a crossover between people watching the game and donating?
Yeah, very definitely. Very definitely. We probably have from our congregation 60 to 75 people that are donating canned goods and or cash. We also publicize it in some of the local newspapers to try to drum up interest and obviously increase contributions.
And so if people were to do that, if people are interested, can they do that at your website?
They can do that at our website, yes, www.oursaviorschurch.org.
That's Greg Nowicki. He is council president at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Burbank. That's in Southwest Cook County. Hey, Greg, thanks for being with me. I should ask you, who are you cheering for in the Super Bowl?
I think the Patriots have won often enough.
Yeah, there we go. That was the right answer. All right. Thanks, Greg. Have a good weekend.
All right. Thank you.
And that does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, by the way, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. You do have to have NPR One enabled. So all of those links, directions for how to do that, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Robin Lynn and Alan Montecilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.